The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon. Great to see you on a warm spring day. It seems we're looking at a part of the Bible that's from a long time ago, from the Old Testament. I'm going to actually pray today that God would help us to understand His Word. You might not be used to praying, but if you'd like to say Amen, if you agree, please do. Please, God, we ask now that You'd help us to understand Your Word. We ask, please, that I could speak clearly and truthfully, and we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Bertrand Russell was, I suppose in some ways, the Richard Dawkins of last century. He lived to be 98 years old. He died in 1970. He was quite a famous philosopher, mathematician, and an outspoken atheist, and attacked Christianity regularly. Here's a quote from Bertrand Russell. He says, "I would never die for my beliefs, because my beliefs might be wrong." And you say, that's logical. It's kind of, it's calm, it's rational and so on, but I can't help but think, you weasel. You've spent your whole life kind of trying to knock down what other people believe, and isn't there anything that you care about enough, anything that you hold so much in the core of your being that you would die for it? It's an interesting question, isn't it? What is it that, for you, what is it that's at the core of your being, something that you believe in so much that you would give your life for it? Now, I know, it sounds like a little bit of a cliche, doesn't it? I die for this or that. But it's worth looking at what is it I really believe, and that'll help determine where it is you draw the line on certain things and how you hold the line. Now, in our society today, I think generally what is it that people live for? I think for many people it's just this kind of general self-gratification, the most comfortable life possible. You hear it said regularly, as long as you're happy. But is that all there is? What are our core convictions? Now, some people would say, well, for me it's family. Yeah, your marriage, your spouse. If you're not married, or if you are married and all marriages go through hard times, what if there's a hard time? Or what if, God forbid, your marriage falls apart, what's left? Or many people will say, no, the kind of the centre of my life, the most important thing is my children. Well, I don't want to spoil the party, but your kids are going to grow up and leave. I know you'll work that out eventually. What then? Or maybe it's my job. But does that mean that you do anything for your job? The meaning of life is found in career. And what is it that's non-negotiable in life? And are there lines that you will not cross? And where do you draw them and why do you draw them there? Now, that's very much at the heart of the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel is a story about a young man who grows into an old man. It's across the span of his life. Daniel and three of his friends. And how is it that they managed to live a life, particularly it's a focus on Daniel, how is it that he managed to live a life where he could not be seduced by money, power and so on, and he couldn't be intimidated? He's firm and he's solid, if you like, he's calm through the chaos around him. What is it about him that means that he can do that? What is it that he believes at the core of his being? Today, we look at Daniel chapter 1. It's kind of an introduction to the book. If you've never read the story of Daniel, go to it during the week. It's found in the middle of the Old Testament. So let me read with you Daniel chapter 1, and we'll see an introduction to this young man. In the third year, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And you see here an artist's impression of Jerusalem burning, Nebuchadnezzar's conquest. Jerusalem at this time, about 600 BC, is only a small city by modern standards. In fact, even at the time of Jesus, Jerusalem, old Jerusalem, would have fitted into Centennial Park. Now, a few kilometres across and big high walls and room for thousands, millions of people and so on, but small. And what are we told? See verse 2. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles of the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in a treasure house of his God. Nebuchadnezzar arrived, and in three successive invasions, he deported a whole lot of the population. Now, his goal was not genocide. His goal really was gathering resources. And so what he did was to take the most educated, the most able, the cream of the population, and bring them back to Babylon. So he took the soldiers, the skilled workers, the members of the royal family, and so on. Why? He had a massive empire. And I'll show you a map here of just how big that empire was in the ancient world. So a little bit more about that later. And in three different deportations, 605 and sort of for the next BC, 605 BC, and for the next 15 or so years, he just took huge amounts of the population into exile in Babylon. Now, in that first deportation in 605 were three young men, Daniel and his three friends. And as the book of Daniel unfolds, Daniel and his friends are there for, well, until they're into their 80s. In fact, as far as we know, they never got to go home. They lived the rest of their life in exile. Now, as you read the story as part of the Old Testament, there's a theological problem here. And it's not just that Nebuchadnezzar was a great military strategist and had a big empire and came and crushed a little city. It's that Jerusalem was the city of God. These were God's people, the God of the Old Testament. And God had promised to Abraham that through his descendants, through the Jewish people, that the whole world would be blessed. 400 years earlier, God had promised to King David that someone would reign on David's throne forever. And how could all this be possible if the city has fallen? Something's wrong. Well, Nebuchadnezzar takes them to the land of Shinar. Where are we? Verse 3. Yes. So the question is this. Craig, can we just have the empire up again, the empire map? Here's a question. How do you rule such a vast empire? I mean, Nebuchadnezzar's no butcher and no fool. He actually cares about his empire. He's a wise ruler. How do you rule an empire that stretches across the ancient world? Now, he didn't have email. He didn't have mobile phones. He didn't have voicemail. And so he didn't get interrupted all the time. But even with that great advantage, you still need some help. And so what he worked out is take the best of the best from the different tribes and people and so on that he'd conquered, and bring them to Babylon and enculturate them in the culture of Babylon, and then get them to help you rule the empire. So see verse 3. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Whoa. Now, I don't know if you can try and think yourself back into that kind of world and what an invitation that is. It really is an invitation to be part of the elite that ruled the world. Amazing. As a plan, it's actually very similar to something that's been done in the relatively modern world, done by a very famous, very rich man called Cecil Rhodes. Now, here's Mr. Rhodes, born 1853, died 1902, became incredibly rich in Africa, and the country of Zimbabwe was previously called Rhodesia, after Cecil Rhodes. Now, no doubt you've heard of the Rhodes Scholarship. A friend of mine a few years ago, a very, very capable young woman, was awarded a Rhodes Scholarship. And as I was reading about Daniel and speaking on it a few years ago, I wrote to her as she was in Oxford in the middle of the scholarship and said, look, I've read what Nebuchadnezzar did in Daniel. Can you see any parallels to what the Rhodes Scholarship and what Nebuchadnezzar's done? And I get back a beautifully written letter. Let me share a little bit of it with you. She said this, as she's in the middle of studying at Oxford. She said, the Rhodes Trust was set up after he died in 1902. And here's a quote from the official website. Rhodes dreamed of improving the world through the diffusion of leaders motivated to serve their contemporaries, trained in the contemplative life of the mind, and broadened by their acquaintance with one another and by their exposure to cultures different from their own. Mr. Rhodes hoped that his plan of bringing able students from throughout the English-speaking world to study at the university where he took his degree in 1881 would aid in the promotion of international understanding and peace. And then she writes, actually, it was more sinister. The Rhodes scholars were explicitly intended to promote the interests of the British Empire around the world. We were all supposed to come to Oxford, be captivated by the glories of England, and go forth as missionaries around the world to lead the colonies and so on, and make sure they acted in the interests of the empire. The criterion which Mr. Rhodes set forth in his will still guides the committees of selection. A number of criterion: 1, literary and scholastic attainments; 2, energy to use one's talents to the full, as exemplified by fondness for and success in sports; truth, courage, devotion to duty, and moral force of character and instincts to lead and take an interest in one's fellow beings. And what difference does it make? She says, in terms of comparing with Daniel and Co.'s opportunity, it takes people not only from rich countries like Australia, US, Germany, Canada, but also from Pakistan, Bangladesh, and many other countries in Africa, brings them to Oxford to study. Once you have the label Rhodes Scholar, doors definitely open. I get a letter every month, probably, from consultancies, the big ones like McKinsey's and so on, who otherwise are so hard to get into, and they're dying for us to work for them. In October, we were invited to a summit in London attended by Salman Rushdie, Mikhail Gorbachev, Roger Bannister, Sir David Frost, Jeremy Irons, Lech Walesa, etc. I've also met Bill Clinton in May, had lunch with Bob Hawke. Surprising numbers of people want me to be a referee for them. There it is, the world at your feet. And to enter this, and then after 3 years, after doing a degree, to stand before the king, which means to be part of his little elite that would rule the world. Now, it's hard to actually think yourself into that situation, and just a whole level of privilege and power that that for the average punter like me, unthinkable. You get a glimpse, just a glimpse of it, some idea. In 2007, you might remember that George W. Bush came to Australia for the APEC summit. Here's a picture of all the leaders in, they must be dry as a bones, okay? Which is pretty conservative given the terrible shirts they usually wear at the end of one of these things. But the Daily Telegraph listed what was involved in George W. Bush coming to Australia. He travelled business class on Qantas with a minder and arrived. Oh, no, he didn't. Listen to this. George W. Bush travelled with 5 chefs, 150 national security advisers, 250 secret service agents, 200 public servants, 50 political aides, and 15 sniffer dog teams. President Bush travelled in the $400 million Air Force One, a mobile command centre designed to withstand a nuclear blast, with an identical Boeing 747 in tow as a backup. Following both aircraft was another 747, which included 150 White House journalists, media staff advisers, three transport planes to carry the presidential helicopter, Marine One, and dozens of motorcade vehicles. Total US delegation, 1,000 people. I love the way the Americans do things in that kind of understated way. But that's the kind of world, if you can think your head into that, that's the kind of world that Daniel has the invitation to be part of. Very kind, very seductive. And Babylon in the ancient world was one of the greatest cities of the ancient world. Time magazine in 2008 ran an article and so on about Babylon, or mentioned it. The 5th century Greek historian Herodotus described a city that extended for 14 miles, 23 kilometres in each direction, divided by the middle, down the middle by the mighty Euphrates, and fortified by 5 sun-dried brick walls, each up to 7 metres thick. We're told that the city was big enough, it had 27 kilometres of walls that were wide enough, thick enough, for chariots to pass one another on the walls. Walls that ran from here to Parramatta. Just massive. Along Babylon's main thoroughfare, the processional way, there were palaces whose glazed bricks were adorned with 120 images of lions to honour Ishtar, the goddess of love and war. The road terminated at the Ishtar Gate, a massive structure encompassing the five fortification walls and rising more than 23 metres. And here's an artist's impression of the Ishtar Gates and the real thing, which is in a museum in Germany, the one on the right, the blue gates. Interesting, really, that take something that's 20 years old and it's theft. Take something that's 2,000 years old, it's archaeology. Anyway, Daniel gets this great invitation. Also, here's an artist's impression of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar built the Hanging Gardens because one of his wives was missing her mountain homeland, and so he had the Hanging Gardens built. That's the level of power and wealth and so on. The world on a platter. The ultimate job. And Daniel is chosen. Verse 6, among those were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official, the Babylonians, gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. Daniel's Jewish name, Daniel, means God is my judge. And each of the names that are given to the four of them actually represent the Babylonian gods. And yet, Daniel and his three friends accept that. Why? You see through the story that Daniel and his friends will actually, wherever possible, cooperate with the Babylonians. Right? Up to a point, will cooperate wherever they can. Why? Because at the time, God has told them that they'll be there for a long time. They need to seek the good of the city. So a contemporary prophet, Jeremiah, is saying this. So let me show you in Jeremiah 29. God says through Jeremiah, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile, all the exiles I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their produce, take wives and have sons and daughters, take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters, multiply there and do not decrease, but seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. You'll be here for a long time. Do good where you can to these people." And that's what Daniel and his friends do. And it's complicated and messy, because the way they looked at knowledge was all kind of mixed up with their gods, the way, you know, the Babylonian gods and so on. So the term Chaldeans comes up often in Daniel. Let me read to you where they are or what it means. It was because the Chaldeans were experts in magic lore, L-O-R-E, that the term Chaldean occurs alongside magicians, enchanters, and sorcerers in Daniel. This was the art for which they became famous and to which they gave their name. The accumulated literature includes omens, magic incantations, prayers, hymns, myths, and legends, scientific formulae for skills such as glassmaking, mathematics, and astrology. So their industrial secrets, their mathematics, their architecture is all mixed up with the worship of all these different gods that they had. Part of the pagan worldview. So it's like, you know, you go to university and you get taught accounting by Athena Star Woman. It's kind of all mixed up. But now, I'm not saying that Daniel worshipped other gods, but Daniel had to live in this and do his best in it and seems to have survived quite well. But there is a line that he will not cross. He won't compromise on some things. And you see the line drawn in verse 8. "But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way." Now here's a beautiful Sunday school picture of Daniel saying no to the food and wine. And what may strike you when you look, they're just kids. I mean, it's quite well drawn and some. They're just kids. They look 15, 16, that kind of age. And I know it looks like it's the 1950s as well, but absolutely right. They were probably just that age. How can we tell? When you put the chapter together, it's likely that Daniel had approximately 64-year public service career. And even if he served into his 80s, he's in his mid-teens when he starts. What is it that gave these young men the courage to say no to the greatest king on earth? Now, why is it that he won't, and the issue that's chosen is that he won't eat the royal food and drink the wine and so on. Now, why does he draw the line here? There's some different theories, all of which could be true. It may be that the food was ritually unclean for Jewish people. You know, if they served pork and so on, they couldn't eat it. But it doesn't quite make sense of why he wouldn't drink the wine, because wine's never unclean. And later on, Daniel speaks about eating meat and so on in Babylon. So it may not be that, although there's plenty of people who would say that's the reason. I'm not quite sure that that's the one. The other possibility is that it was the food had been sacrificed to their gods. And because it had been sacrificed to these pagan gods, Daniel and his friends wouldn't eat it. Possible, but it's likely that all food, even the vegetables, was kind of dedicated to their gods. And that's more likely kind of taking a problem in the New Testament and reading it back into the Old. I think the most likely is that Daniel understood there's no free lunches. What do I mean by that? To share a meal, to eat with somebody, builds relationship, obligation, loyalty. One of the great criticisms of Jesus by his, you know, his religious critics was this, that Jesus ate with sinners. People who weren't religious and weren't pure, and Jesus ate with them, which meant what? He accepted them. There's an obligation, a friendship, a relationship that builds. One of the great criticisms of Judas was that Judas ate with Jesus and then betrayed him. When you eat with someone, you're accepting them. There's an obligation that builds. Now, it's the same today, isn't it? Why, I know we kind of all say, oh, no, this isn't the case, but why is it that business people spend money entertaining one another? Why is it that there's a corporate box for someone and you customers are invited to watch the Wallabies or the Swans or whoever it is? The answer is hospitality brings obligation. And Daniel understood that very clearly. And he said, no. It's different. It's actually in another part of the Bible, in the book of 2 Kings, which is one of the history books that explain what happened with Judah and the fall of Jerusalem and so on, one of the kings of Judah who's captured by Nebuchadnezzar and then ends up living in Babylon, Jehoiachin, is released towards the end of his life, and we're told he eats at the table of the king of Babylon every day. But I don't think it's meant to be a happy story. It's more saying things are so bad that the king of Judah now eats like a lapdog at the table of the king of Babylon. These young men won't do it. He's drawn the line. Missing out on meat, that's a big thing, right? To face up to being a vegetarian for however long it took. You're talking to a man who'd very happily have a dessert steak most nights. It's not just that he decided to do without meat. It could have actually cost him his life. And the eunuch who's in charge of giving them food realizes that. See verse 9. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, I'm afraid, my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. I am afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. So he's not prepared to take the risk. He knows head comes off if the orders aren't carried out. So Daniel tries again, and he tries a little lower down the food chain, shall we say, with the steward who oversees it. Verse 11, Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and wine and they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. Probably not too hard to guess where all the nice food and wine ended up, but everyone's happy. And so you then jump forward 3 years to when they finished their degree, verse 17. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus, which is, assuming we began in 605 BC, Cyrus takes power in 539 BC, 66 years. So Daniel's over 80 years old when he finishes. And so this chapter, what it does is set the scene for the life of Daniel. And what you, just the vibe you get about him is how he's wise and calm and honourable for the next 60 years. How he stands up to kings, he treats them well, you know, he's honourable and respectful, but stands up to kings, is calm in the middle of chaos, he won't be seduced by power or bribery or riches, and he won't be intimidated. Why? Because he knew his God and he trusted him. He knew his God and he trusted him. And Daniel had the eyes to see, to know that, God's hand is still in control. In fact, there's 3 times during this chapter, I haven't pointed it out, but let me just show you quickly, 3 times in this chapter that show the hand of God still at work. Did you notice? First time in verse 2, and the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. And that is theological problem? Well, not really. God had warned Israel, had warned Judah again and again and again, if you keep serving other gods, if you keep walking away from me, I will, as I've warned you, throw you out of the promised land. 300 years he warned them again and again through the prophets and deaf ears, and so finally the judgment of God came. And what's Daniel understand? God controls the nations, God controls history, and so he need not fear the future. Second time, see verse 9. Now God had caused the official to show favour and sympathy to Daniel. God's in control of hearts and minds and decisions, and Daniel's fate doesn't lie in the hands of this bureaucrat. Daniel's fate lies in the hands of a God who controls hearts and minds and so on, and so Daniel doesn't fear other people. And you see that through all the stories. He's not afraid of people. God even makes him strong and healthy and so on as he eats the different food for that 10 days. And the third thing, see verse 17, to these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature. And Daniel knows over his lifetime the brilliance that he has, and he is a brilliant administrator. The brilliance that he has comes from God. It's a gift. And when someone's given you a gift, you don't be proud about it, you be thankful. And so Daniel is able to be humble at the same time as being brilliant. And he'd learnt what? As he lived in the among the Babylonians, to cooperate without compromise. Cooperate without compromise. Why? Because his core belief is an understanding of his God and how God would have him live. Now, I began by asking, what are your core beliefs? What is it that you truly, deeply understand? What is it you hold most strongly to? Professor Ian Harper, who's now with Access Economics, in the 2009 Smith Lecture here in Sydney, said this about self-gratification. He says, the Bible points to the need for our lives to serve a higher purpose than self-gratification through money, power, or fame. It does so because self-gratification is ultimately futile. In fact, it's no gratification at all. It leaves you feeling empty and dissatisfied, or as even modern secular psychologists are pointing out, anxious and possibly clinically depressed. You might like to read a book by Robert Lane called The Loss of Happiness in Market Democracies. Lane's book makes no pretension at being a religious or moral tract by any means. It's a piece of secular psychological research. Yet amazingly enough, Lane concludes that if your life is driven by only extrinsic motivations, extrinsic goals rather than intrinsic goals, not only will you feel dissatisfied and empty, you'll actually make yourself sick. It's empty in the end. Do you know, we can actually know God better than Daniel, because we live after God's greatest revelation to us in the person of Jesus. And Jesus calls us to follow him, and yes, that will cost. That will often be difficult. And yet he says doing that will give us something, someone, much bigger to live for. And that we'll not need to fear other people, that we won't be intimidated. Why? Because we can learn to live with an audience of one. And we won't be seduced by money or possessions or whatever, because we'll find our security and our significance in knowing God. If you have time in the next week, you might like to read chapter 4, which is all about pride and Nebuchadnezzar learning a lesson.
Thanks, Al. Now it's your turn. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, what would you die for?
In one way, it seems a cliche and so far away from what we expect to experience, but it's worth asking yourself that question because it helps you focus on what really matters to you. Now, I hope I'd lay down my life for the Lord Jesus. I think I would. It's one of those things where someone else in the Bible was very quick to jump up and say, "I'll give my life for you, Lord." And he didn't do so well. So, yeah, that's right. So I hope that I would. It's interesting, when the pressure's on, people do stand up for what they really love. I don't know if you noticed that there were three men died in that Colorado massacre during the Batman movie. Three men that threw themselves across their girlfriends, held their girlfriends down on the floor and were killed, and their girlfriend survived. You will give your life for what you truly, deeply love. But I'm just going to say, I hope I would.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.